FM. This is Connected, episode 76. This week's show is brought to you by Braintree and Squarespace. My name is Stephen Hackett. I'm joined this week by my friend, Mr. Federico Vitici.
Hello, Stephen.
Hello, friend.
How are you, friend?
I'm doing well. Our British friend is he's not here.
So today. The time has finally come. He's
he might actually be dead. He's under the weather, and as someone who speaks for a living, that's no good. So he is with some hot water and ginger, I think is what you told him to drink. So hopefully he's doing that.
That's my recipe for fighting this kind of nasty disease. Mike, I know he's listening live to the show. It puts a lot of pressure on me. It's almost, when I told you when your boss is watching you do your work, this is really what it feels like. I hope we won't disappoint you, Mike. Stephen, I know that we have some follow-up.
We do have some follow-up. So up first, we are revisiting the Canary, which is the, if you remember, sort of the all-in-one Internet of Things type security system that you can put in your home, where it has a camera and like an alarm, a bunch of other stuff. And Dan Morin has one, and he wrote this thing up over on Six Colors, basically tying it to his Wemo switch. So, for instance, if the, you can turn a light off and it triggers something on the Canary, and you can kind of build these workflows to start tying all these things together, which I think is pretty neat.
Yeah. Again, I wish I could buy these. I didn't know the Wink protocol before. Is this like a device or an API or both?
I want to say both, but I'm not totally positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only automation that I do, it's very lightweight automation with IFTTT and my the Philips lights, and there's some Elgato stuff that I do with the sensors that I have, but mostly I find myself just using the native iOS widgets to quickly control my lights and other home connected devices. It's just faster when I'm on my local Wi-Fi network. I just need to swipe down and control my lights. And I tried a bunch of third-party Philips Hue clients, from third-party developers. But really, I come down to just using the official app because it's faster. It doesn't do any weird things with my local IP address. The third-party U apps, for some reason, always stop working for me at a certain point. And I'm using the simplest solution of them all, which is the native widget. But still, this looks pretty cool. I gotta investigate this Wink protocol, which is nice. They do have a product called Wink Relay, which, when I think about it, it's like you and Mike winking, Wink Relay. But still,
close
anyway.
Enough.
Yeah.
The thing for me with all this stuff is that all the home automation stuff is very Wild West feeling right now, where you can get all these services and apps and kind of tie them together yourself. And I think the promise of HomeKit is all this stuff can be like, we're going to build one common layer for all this stuff. And I think Google's trying to do that as well. It just still seems to me that it's like, I have this hesitancy about it. Like, I can invest in all this stuff, and then in 2 years, none of it talk to each other. It still feels very early days, and that's fine. Like, I understand if I buy the Hue smart lights, or like I've had a Canary on my mind since we recorded, that this, I think, is going to change significantly over the course of the next couple of years, and there may be some early adopter tax to pay here.
Yeah, it reminds me of the XKCD comic on standards. Have you ever seen that one?
I have. It's a good one.
Yeah. There are 14 competing standards. We need another one. And now there's like 15 competing standards. Really, this is the situation right now with home devices. There's the Google one, the Apple one, a bunch of third-party ones. And really, it's great to have standards. But at which point, a lot of standards is too many. And we'll see how it plays out in the end, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, early days, and it's that's not unusual, right? I mean, you saw that in everything from personal computing operating systems all the way through now. It's just, this is part of the the life cycle of technology. And it's just a fun reminder sometimes that something you invest in today or set up today to work, it, you know, may not be bulletproof forever.
Yeah, I mean, and in the end, we're all going to die. So, you know.
Well, wow. Well, I mean,
you also got to consider that.
Yeah, I feel like that's sort of the trump card in any conversation. It's like, well, the iPad sales are down. Well, we're all going to die anyways.
You want to talk about it?
Briefly, they did a really good job. I will point out yesterday's episode of Upgrade. They cover this in depth. So I don't want to retread all of it, but short version is the iPad year over year is what, 25% down. It's not great, right? I mean, that's not good news. I think that there's the thought of, well, the iPad Pro was late or the iPad Air wasn't revved. And I think while those things are true, I don't think it accounts for such a huge drop. My thought is at least that the iPad is still finding its sort of the size that it's supposed to be. You know, it was huge at the beginning and now it's settling. And it's taking a long time to find where that number is. It's not to say the iPad isn't still a big business, of course, but it's, I suspect that it will drop some more and eventually it will level off into some sort of stasis where, like, this is the size of Apple's tablet business. And until they find that number, you're going to continue to get quarterly results like this where it's a big decrease year over year. And I do think it will level out somewhere. You know, maybe it's the size of the Mac. Maybe it's bigger. Maybe it's smaller. But it's definitely not the next iPhone.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see the iPad kind of, you know, leveling off somewhere in between the iPhone and the Mac, probably closer to a Mac. It's important not to lose perspective, I think. When Apple sells 20 million Macs a year and they still sell 54, 55 million iPads a year, it's still quite a big difference. And I mean, the decrease is obvious and it's been going on for, you know, for a few years now. But to me, it always comes down to a very fundamental question. For me, it is, do you believe that in the future, when you're not on your smartphone for, you know, doing tasks that you cannot do on a small screen, do you believe that the big screen is going to be a laptop or a big multi-touch tablet? And that's the very basic question. And we can argue that the iPad has been decreasing, still bigger than the Mac, and they're still selling a lot of iPads. But there's been a decrease, and it's been slowing down. And that's, you know, objective to observe. But if you gotta think about the future, do you see the laptop with the physical keyboard, you know, and the traditional desktop metaphors, or do you see the tablet? And personally, I see the tablet. So when I'm not on the smartphone, I want to be using, you know, a multi-touch display big enough to, you know, to type on, to view movies and, you know, to collect my photos and organize, you know, all my media and documents. And there's people who prefer desktops, and I agree with you. It'll level off at some point. And my personal theory is that it'll still be bigger than the Mac, but we'll see. It's funny whenever there's this kind of financial result. A lot of people seem kind of to be rooting for the iPad to die, as if they need to prove a point. I don't think nobody has to prove a point here, because this is great that Apple's still selling 20 million Macs, more than 15 million iPads and iPhones. God even knows what's the real number. I think it's great, but some people seem to kind of have some sort of a, what's the German word for, you know, pleasure from others' pain? Schadenfreude.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one. Oh, I mean, I'm asking you, of all people.
I don't know.
But yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I remain, you know, with a shade of optimism in me.
I think that's totally fair, and I agree with you. I do think that the iPad, its groove will be larger than the Macs. That wherever it settles down, it will be more than what Apple's selling with the Mac line, but how much bigger, you know, is really hard to say. But I do think that fundamental question of, like, what do you use when you're not on your smartphone is a really interesting one, because for a lot of people, and I mean, also even speak for me, that the smartphone can be my only computer some days. And in my previous life, it was my computer most work days, you know, where I was out doing client stuff all day, running around, and I could do email and I could do team management and task management, all this stuff from my phone, where it really was the main device. And, you know, if I think about the range of computing devices in my life, the one that I would have the hardest time giving up is the iPhone. You know, I could do without the iPad. I could get my work done without a Mac, but take the iPhone away, that is like a bigger hurdle for me, because it is like the primary device that I go to so often. And I think that's like, I mean, that says a lot about what the smartphone has become, right? That it is, for so many people, an indispensable part of their workflow and their life. And to see that being really like the question of like what is, you know, if you put your software down, what do you go to? I think is a really interesting way of looking at it. And for me right now, it's the Mac, but it is increasingly the iPad. And even, you know, over the last several months for Mike, it's been the iPad more than the Mac. So I think people will end up where they end up. And, you know, maybe the Mac and the iPad will be more siblings than anything else. And I think that's fine. It's still a business that I think is obviously worth Apple continue to invest in and continue to do. And, you know, that mindset of, well, you know, the iPad's not a real computer, and so I want it to not do well, like, that's just silly to me, right? Like,
yeah,
who cares? Then don't buy one. Then, like, don't listen to Canvas. Like, whatever, it's fine. Yeah. But there are people who do depend on it and who do their work on it and who care about it, and it's still a viable product. At the end of the day, wherever it finds its sales numbers, you know, then that's that.
Yeah, the way I see it, it always comes down to anthropology in a way. Humans are animals that like sitting down. And this is why I don't completely buy the argument that someone can use a smartphone as their only computer. Because at one point you're gonna, you know, have the desire of sitting down and crave a bigger screen. I can use my iPhone as my only computing device. That doesn't mean that, you know, when I'm sitting down at my desk or on the couch, I don't wish for a bigger screen to watch a movie or to read a book or an article, you know. I believe the smartphone will in the future will be something essential, like having an internet connection at home or, you know, having electricity. You will have a smartphone, which is a small computer that's always with you. But humans, as a, you know, as a species, they like sitting down, resting, and when you're in that sort of scenario, you want a bigger screen. So we'll see where it ends up. It can be a Mac, it can be an iPad, it can be a mix of the two. It can be VR, for that matter. I don't know. I doubt that, but, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
Imagine having a Finder in VR, Steven.
I don't want to think about that.
Imagine all the bugs and crashes in VR. That's gonna be awesome.
Wow. I did definitely notice in last week's Canvas that you made reference to the Finder in past tense.
Oh yeah.
Like, on the Mac there was the Finder. Like, no, it's still here. It's right. He's smiling at me right now.
Yeah. For me, it's sort of a past version of me. So.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Speaking of things that are past tense, has Google updated Docs for iOS 9?
I don't even know why are we still subjecting ourselves to this?
To make a point, I think.
It's, for me, Google Docs is like watching the news on TV. Every day there's like bad news, and this is really similar. You know, you turn on the TV and bad stuff is going on, you look at Google Docs and nothing's going on. And it's bad. So, no update, Steven. This is sort of becoming like the section when we used to tell people where to find the show notes. We needed to come up with a new excuse or, you know, a clever way of saying that every single time. There's no Google Docs update with iOS 9 multitasking. I'm sorry, friends.
It's a bad day. All right, we're going to get into some topics. But first, I'm going to tell you about our first sponsor, which is Braintree. Braintree is code for easy online payments. If you're a mobile app developer, check out Braintree. It's the payment solution used by companies that you might have heard of, like Uber, Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, and Munchery. Braintree has made the payment experience in these apps both seamless and magical. You can now add a similar experience to your own app. With excellent customer service and simple integration, Braintree gets you ready to receive payments quickly. Braintree's continuous support plus fast payouts means you'll be prepared as your company grows from its first dollar to your billionth. Braintree is helping solve the problem of mobile card abandonment by offering a best-in-class mobile checkout experience. And they make payment experiences in some of your favorite apps, like I said, seamless and magical. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all your payment types your customers might want, including PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and more, all with a single integration. You don't have to go out and do different things for all those payment methods, all one single integration that is with you across all your platforms. And with superior fraud protection and fantastic customer service and fast payouts, you really should check out Braintree. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/connected. Thank you to Braintree for supporting this show and all of Relay FM.
So, Steven, what did you buy this time? I know it's an old Mac.
It is an old Mac.
This is something special.
The 20th anniversary Mac. So, in 1996, Apple, the company, was 20 years old. They announced, hey, we're going to build a Mac to celebrate this. It took them a year. So in 1997, the 20th anniversary Mac, or the TAM, was released. And it was $7,500. And it had a crazy startup tone. It came with a giant subwoofer and had an LCD and a desktop, which sounds familiar if you're sitting in front of an iMac. And it's really... So one of the holy grails of Apple computing, if I could use that phrase, where there's not many of them out there. They really only sold, depending on what you see, 6,000, 10,000 of them. That number is actually hard to nail down. Anyway, so I've been looking at one for a long time, and I turned 30 last week, and Mike and some other people basically were like, you should do this, and... badgered me into it, and so I did it, and it showed up, and I made a video about it, and it's amazingly weird.
So how did you get one, if you may know?
The beauty of eBay.
Oh, okay. So traditional way.
Yeah. Well, when a mom and dad and a Mac love each other very much. Yes, but they pop up on eBay from time to time, and I've been looking for a while. This particular one was a good bit less than what they normally go for, which was nice. And the reason I found out it's not quite pristine. If you look at the video, it's not a perfect example. There are a couple issues here and there, but overall, it's in good shape. And it's a crazy machine, man. It's
a working machine because you reinstalled the OS.
I did. So it ships with system 7.6.1, which is ancient.
So did you have an archive of these system OSs on your drives?
I didn't have this, but it came. This came with the all the original CDs. So the software CD, it came with so if you look at pictures of this thing, there's this big like external unit, and that's, like I said, a sub, and then the power supplies in there. And to show that off, it was a Bose system. Bose shipped a 2-CD set of different types of music. There's like classical, there's rock, there's like this crazy techno song that I can't get out of my head to like show off this thing. And the CD player and everything could be used separately from the computer. So it was like big sound system stuff. So anyways, all that stuff came with it. And so I basically just put the system disk in the CD drive and formatted the drive and started clean with it.
Mm-hmm. How does the Bose speaker sound?
It's really great. Like it holds up. It's
Nice.
It does. I listened to the CDs that came with it, and then we had a couple CDs around the house. I popped in it, and it really does sound good. Like it may be 19 years old, but it. It sounds great. And
so how's using System 7
it's
today?
Bad, man.
What can you do? I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's old, and so this thing will run up through macOS 9, which is much more modern and in some key areas. There's no doubt that it's old. I mean, so I have a couple of things on there. I don't have a ton of classic macOS software, but I really don't see myself like booting this machine up all that often anyways. I think I have some other Macs that are far less rare to do that on, but System 7 is pretty old. This thing comes, this particular unit has an Ethernet card in it, and that's like a separate set of extensions to like for TCP IP to work. Like it really is old school, and it feels much older than even OS 8 and OS 9 do. So, but it's really eye opening to see how far we've come.
Do you know if anyone from this team that made System 7 is still working at Apple today?
I would think so. I would think surely there's someone kicking around still. I mean, that really was only 20 years ago. But it's definitely, there's nothing. I mean, OS X and iOS have nothing to do with this system. Like it's totally different in every way.
So what's the story of this particular Mac?
I think the big thing about that makes this computer special is that it was unique for the time, and it really, I really think that it was, you know, if you think about 1997, Apple is, you know, before the next acquisition, it's before Jobs comes back. Really, this was developed in 1996. Apple was on the ropes, right? They had a bunch of Macs that no one cared about. They made way too many of them, and there was no distinguishing one from another. Their system software was in trouble. It was aging quickly. They were bleeding users to Windows. And I think Apple, whether consciously or not, swung for the fences with this computer in a way that was really unusual for the time. There is I'll put it in the show notes. There's a Johnny Ive video for this computer, and it's kind of funny because Johnny Ive is like young and has sideburns, and it's all very strange.
Yes, it's very young.
But what he says in that video and the things they talk about in it, like, resonate today. So things like Apple cares about design and cares about the details that no one sees. You know, there's a joke that Steve Jobs used to tell that the back of his computer looked better than the front of anyone else's. That phrase ends up more or less in this video, where they talk about the way that it's put together on the back and like the way that everything is paid attention to. I mean, for example, there where you plug in your keyboard and stuff on this computer, there's a photo of it in my YouTube video. There's cable routing. So there's little clips you can put the cables in and then a cover that goes over them so you don't have to see, like, if you have this out on the desk in an open office, someone walks past it, they don't see your cables. They're all tucked behind this little plate. All those little details, using an LCD and a desktop, which was unheard of in 1996, making it more than a computer but an entertainment system. So with the Bose system, you could also tune it to FM radio, and you could watch TV on it. You could bring coax right into the computer. Like all these things, like entertainment, design, great sound, a striking design. I mean, even at 20 years old, this computer in its own way is beautiful and unique. That's all stuff Apple cares about today. And so what was so surprising to me was to see the seeds of that before Steve Jobs comes back. I think it's easy. I think I've done it. It's easy to write off 90s Apple like it was just a dumpster fire and Steve Jobs and company came in and saved it. Well, some of that renaissance was already going on, and I really think that has everything to do with Johnny Ive. You get the sense that this was the first project that he was really allowed to kind of go crazy on. And there's some problems with that. It's not a perfect system, but it is one that very much feels like the Apple we know today, and that is just really interesting to me.
Yeah, it's for some reason he reminds me of the Bose speaker. It's kind of similar to the Mac Pro.
Yeah, you know. It's someone made that joke on Twitter. It is that sort of circular shape. But
it's a very fancy computer, if you ask me. Like, for a vintage computer, it's not like an ugly piece of plastic, you know, like a beige box. It looks beautiful to me. And even I'm looking now at pictures of the back. There's like a fan in the top right corner. There's a six-color Apple logo in the center. I mean, it looks really nice. And you posted the picture of this Mac compared to an iMac, and you can clearly see the evolution, or at least like the line of thinking, you know, evolving throughout two decades. It's probably one of your best purchases, Steven. At least from my audience point of view, it's really an interesting product to watch in the video, which you published on YouTube today for your new YouTuber career.
I don't know about career.
I really liked the video. What was the process shooting the video this time?
Yeah, so I've been pretty open that this YouTube thing is very experimental for me. It's something that I don't have the I'm not a video guy by default. Like, I'm learning this really as I go, and so each one I am purposefully introducing a new element. So this time it was the motion. So a lot of those sliding shots done with my camera mounted on a slider. And so I'm, like I said, I'm learning as I go. So I had, I had the script written. I kind of knew what shots I needed, and then spent basically a day yesterday up at the office shooting it. And it's done on sort of that infinite white backdrop, which I have done with like a giant roll of white butcher paper and some fancy table placement. It's really shockingly low tech, but what excites me about doing this is that it's a way to extend like what I'm doing. I wrote about the 20th anniversary Mac years ago, and like all the tech specs and all the things why it's technically interesting, and that's fine. Like, there's a place for those articles, and I will continue to do those articles. But what video lets me do is sort of tell the story of something in a different way. So like this video, I very purposefully did not talk about the specs. Like, it came with a 603 processor, and it really should have probably been a 604 because it was underpowered and some of them ran hot. And like, that doesn't matter for this sort of stuff. What matters is that this is like you said, it's a unique looking computer. Like, this paint color, the startup chime, all of it is one off. Like, stuff done on this computer was never done again. And video lets me tell that story that is harder to get across in an article. And so this whole project, or whatever this becomes, is really an idea of being able to extend what I'm already doing on 512, but sort of in like a new way. And the hope is that this is wildly successful and becomes part of what 512 is. But for now, it is just me sort of experimenting and learning and seeing what works and what doesn't.
Well, down the road, 512 Museum. That's what I'm telling you. You gotta have a museum with all your old Macs. I just found a picture of Seinfeld with the 20th anniversary Mac.
Yeah. There's one. It's the other kind of famous product placement is it shows up in Batman and Robin, I think. And Alfred like burns a CD on it, which this computer can't do, but it's kind of funny. They definitely showed up, and you know, you know it's a TAM because it's the only computer that looks like this, which I think is pretty awesome.
Yeah. So what's can you give us a hint of what's your next must-have old Mac purchase in your dream list?
I think the Macintosh TV is pretty high on the list still.
What's a Macintosh TV?
So it is I think what year it was. I'm looking 1993, and I'll put a link in the chat room.
Oh my god, it's black.
It is
Macintosh TV,
and it is in some ways related to the TAM. So the Macintosh TV, you could watch TV on it as well, but you could either watch TV or work on it as a Mac. You couldn't do both.
It's
basically like a 14-inch CRT Performa. What's kind of sad, if you look at this date, it was for sale from October 1993 to February 1994.
Oh,
it was for sale for like 5 months. which was sad. And it ran system 7.1 to 7.6. And so the TAM runs 7.6. So it's like, that kind of shows you how slow the OS had become. Like, we were in system 7 for a long time. These are probably as rare as the TAM. They don't go for as much. I think that a lot of people just think, oh, it's black. That's interesting. But I would say that's on the short list still.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for the Macintosh TV. This is crazy. Only 10,000 were made. Yeah.
It on remember Apple's 30th Mac birthday thing they did a couple years ago?
Yeah.
They did that slideshow of like a computer per year. I believe that the Macintosh TV was 1993's pick for that. Which is just sad because it wasn't for sale for very long. But maybe one of these will show up one day. So I have plenty of more stuff to make videos about though without buying anything else, which is good because I've depleted my collection money for a while. So
yeah, we both know that's not gonna happen. So yeah, we'll see what happens. I do love the TAM video, Steven. Well done.
Thanks, man. Oh, we didn't mention. We got to mention this real quick. We'll put a link in the show notes to the Welcome Tour video.
Oh yes! Oh my God! Why do they? What's the reason for that weird looking video?
So it came on a CD. It came preloaded on the computer out of the box, and the video makes it a little more disjointed because it was actually a Mac app, and you could click through and watch these different video clips. I just put them all together into one long video, but it is a part tour of the computer. So like this is how the trackpad works, because this thing came with a trackpad instead of a mouse with like leather inserts around it. It's all very strange. And then really my favorite part is towards the end where it's just this multimedia extravaganza. So yes. Like yes. There's a tear falls from an eye that makes ripples in a water that becomes the strings on a cello. And then what I put in the 20th anniversary Mac video is this drawing of an old Western like poster that then gets hit by lightning and becomes a guitar player who's alive with a train in the background.
Yes.
It's all very
LSD inspired.
Yeah, and what I can't reconcile is that I think this was weird even for 1997.
Yes.
Like my impression, having shared this like with some people who were around and even covering Apple at the time, they're like, yeah, that was strange.
Well, I don't remember. I mean, I was alive in 1997. I was, 8? I wasn't that weird. I don't remember people being into these sort of weird things. So the video was definitely weird at the time, and it is even worse now. So maybe it was a way to showcase this CGI capabilities at the time? No idea. Like, I'm coming up short with explanations.
Yeah, it's not great.
I mean, if you were to put this video in a time capsule and, you know, save it for the future, and people looking back at this video, that they could think, man, people were weird in 1996. I mean,
yeah.
The cowboy with the guitar and the train and the tear and it's awesome. You should go check it out on YouTube. it's a must watch in its very own way.
Yeah, so that's the Welcome Tour video. So all these links will be in the show notes at relay.fm/connected/76 or in your app of choice. So, Frederick, let's talk about AirMail for a little bit.
Okay.
So what's AirMail up to?
So it's AirMail is came out originally in 3 years ago in 2013, shortly after Google acquired Sparrow. You remember that email client that everyone fell in love with?
Out.
Yes. Arguably, it was according to many people, one of the best email clients that were made, you know, after the Tweety era of modern Mac app design. And Google bought Sparrow, and these Italian guys from Bloop, it's the name of the company, came out with this AirMail client for the desktop. So it was an email client with support for IMAP and Gmail and eventually iCloud. And it was very powerful, and it evolved, especially after version 2, I believe in 2014, to have a variety of power user features. So you could have like Markdown. You could write in Markdown and have a preview of rich text while writing a message. You could have filters for search, or you know, you could have a lot of customization options. And now they made Airmail for iPhone. So I've been... And again, you know, as the joke goes, I've been testing this iPhone version since about November, I think, or early December. It launched yesterday on the App Store. I have a review on Mac Stories. And I, every time a new email client comes out, it gets people talking. And I believe the reason is the default mail app, especially if you use Gmail, and you know, just yesterday Google said there's a billion people using Gmail every month. The mail app experience with Gmail on iOS is not great, so it doesn't have any specific Gmail features. And this probably comes down to, you know, the war between Apple and Google. You don't have push notifications. The interface of the Apple Mail app is very much a classic, you know, traditional one. It works well for IMAP and iCloud, but for Gmail and, you know, the crazy things that Gmail does on top of email, you cannot have those in the mail app. And most notably, again, fast search and push notifications. So Airmail tries to offer like a modern email experience based on the features and design that others have tried in the past few years on iOS. And I mean, it's kind of obvious that it borrows heavily from Mailbox, which, you know, again, putting one out, it's going away at the end of the month. So you have modern features such as snoozing, or, you know, you can browse contacts. There's better support for attachments, so you can integrate with third-party file management services like Box and Dropbox if you want to import an attachment from those services, or like save an attachment directly from email to one of those locations. So it builds on top of what others have been doing for the past few years, but it doesn't try to do a lot of that like smart automatic categorization of messages, similar to what you can find in Spark by Riddle, or notably Inbox, which is the alternative Gmail app from Google. It's mostly like a collection of features from the past few years in iOS email clients. So there's a little bit of Outlook, there's a little bit of Mailbox. There's the app integrations are very similar to what Dispatch has been doing on the iPhone and iPad. So as I argue in my review, Airmail is a really power user oriented client. There's a lot of customization. You can change a lot of settings, probably even too many for most people. It gives you complete control over appearance, workflow. You can change everything. One of the key features is iCloud Sync. So if you use Airmail on the Mac, you can activate iCloud Sync for two reasons. One, it lets you import an account. So you don't have to type in your email address if you want to add it on another device. And the second one, possibly even the most useful one, you can sync settings across platforms. So if you say, when I mean snooze until morning, but my morning is, you know, noon because I wake up late, I want this setting to be available across the Mac and the iPhone. And with iCloud Sync and Airmail, you can do that.
I wish more apps would do that. I mean, yeah. So often I'll set something up just the way I want it, and then I'll pick up my iPad and it's doing something totally different. And
yeah,
I don't know how hard that is. I mean, I get the sense that I was in the beta and been playing it with this some more. The setting stuff in Airmail is really deep. And I agree with you that I think to a degree there's too much fiddliness in there that I think some people will find that overwhelming. But the fact that it does sync really is nice, and I wish that more developers who are cross-platform, not just iOS, but especially on the Mac as well, like, spend the time to do that, because it really is such a nice feature, especially when you have, you know, sometimes I have four toggles, like, who cares? I can go in and set my four settings, but this thing has just seemingly endless number of options.
Yeah.
And going through, like, with your phone in one hand, sitting at your Mac, like, changing all the check boxes so they're the same, get super old quickly, and yep. So I really like that about Airmail.
Yeah, there are some parts that are rough, and in my review I call them not finished. some of them are like related to performance. So scrolling isn't always fixed at 60 frames per second. You can get kind of, you know, jittery when scrolling, which I don't like, of course. Sometimes animations kind of get stuck. So when you perform swipes to run actions, there's some UI glitches there. The way that the signature comes up on screen is kind of weird looking. And there are some features that, while not problematic from a technical point of view, are just not there, such as, I mean, notably, there's no iPad version, and some options of the Mac app are not available yet, so you cannot write in Markdown, or you cannot create saved searches. There's no filters for search. So it's a solid beginning, but there's still some issues from a technical point of view and some features that are missing. And the big problem for me, and I believe for Mike, and I think for a lot of people, is that there's no iPad version. The problem here is when you try one of these modern email apps with features such as, you know, snooze settings to move a message from one folder to another at a certain time, or, you know, when you activate sync and you want to have all these preferences in a certain way, not having the same app on all of your devices becomes a problem. And for me, because I don't use a Mac, I use the iPhone and iPad, I want to have the same email client with the same settings, with the same conventions, with the same design even, because doing email is something I don't like, and if I have to do, which I do, I want to make sure that I'm fast and that I know how to do that. So if you have a Mac and an iPhone, you don't work on the iPad, I recommend trying AirMail, because, you know, on the Mac and on the iPhone, it works nicely. For people like us, I think not having an iPad version at launch is a problem. Now, the developers are working on an iPad version. There's going to be supposedly an iPad beta soon. But as always in these cases, launching with an iPhone app with the promise of an iPad version down the road doesn't do much right now. I have a need for email on my iPad right now, which means that, you know, I gotta use Outlook on both the iPhone and the iPad. But I think AirMail is going to strike a chord with power users. And I know that it did the same on the Mac. A lot of people use AirMail on the Mac because it's got all of these options and settings that if you're extremely, you know, nitpicky or geeky about your email, you're gonna appreciate having on iOS. What I wanted to kind of discuss briefly with you, so from my conclusion, I just quickly touched upon the email market on iOS today. So it seems kind of crazy to me that, you know, just 7 years ago, Apple wasn't even accepting third-party email clients on the App Store. And now the market has flourished, you know, since Sparrow came out, 2010, 2011, maybe on the iPhone. There's so much choice right now, and big companies are making email apps. So there's Gmail, Inbox, Outlook, Yahoo email if you use it, and there's third-party developers. And it's there seems to me that there's much, much more innovation on the iOS App Store for email than on the Mac.
Yeah, and it's going on the Mac too. There's obviously there's AirMail, Polymail I think is in beta.
Yeah,
I think what it really speaks to is that Apple's first-party client just hasn't kept up, especially when you look at some Gmail-specific things. And my guess is that's only going to get worse. You know, at some point, Gmail, I mean, they're building a superset of stuff on top of IMAP. And it's not that you can't archive mail. I mean, that the basics work in Apple's first-party client. But these other features that people have built on top of Gmail, snoozing and all this other stuff, eventually, we're going to get to a point where IMAP can't support that sort of thing. And so either Google will move to their own thing completely, which they have hinted at that they may do at some point, or you're going to be in a situation where you're waiting on Apple to, you know, get around to, oh, next year when the new version of iOS comes out, then they may include this stuff. And, you know, historically, Apple's been slow to have, like, great support for other people's stuff. And, you know, the iOS supports and OS X support Exchange, and they support, you know, the basics of Gmail. But at some point, I think that riff is going to become too great. And I think with that on the horizon, a lot of these third-party developers have jumped in and are building clients who, you know, work really well with all that stuff and give people what they expect from a Gmail experience. And I think that Apple has created this this hole in the market of, like, their app is great if you use iCloud or if you use Gmail without all the bonus stuff. But if you really want some of these nice power user features, then Mail is in line with a bunch of other Apple apps that don't get the job done, right? Like, Mail has become something like Reminders or before this year, Notes, right? Where it's a simple app and it's fine for a lot of people and it's, you know, it gets the job done, but anyone who needs more power is going to go to a third party. And things like Evernote happened, and things like, you know, Instapaper and Pocket as opposed to Reading List, and things like OmniFocus and Todoist and To-Do instead of Reminders. And I think what we're seeing is that happening in Mail clients in a big way.
Yeah. But I totally wouldn't be surprised to see iOS 10 with snoozes in the Mail app. I mean, it's one of those features that Apple wants or needs to Sherlock eventually, because so many people are using it. And it's a third-party innovation that, you know, Apple isn't afraid of being inspired from, as you would say. It's really copying, but, you know, it's one of those third-party conventions that eventually becomes like a standard in iOS apps, like Pull to Refresh, or what's the other one that they did? Reading List, Pull to Refresh. There was another one. Swipe Gestures on email from Mailbox. That also wasn't an Apple Mail feature. You know, now it's almost second nature for millions of people. You know, I believe that eventually we will get snooze settings in Apple Mail, maybe based on Reminders and iCloud. I don't know, but I want to see Apple have really better integration with Gmail. I know that's probably, you know, utopia scenario because, you know, Apple and Google, but one can dream. And if dreaming is not enough, we'll still have the App Store, you know? So
I guess my question for you is, we're seeing all this flourish of activity, but the road behind us is littered with the carcass of dead email clients or dying email clients. And I wonder if, is there room for a successful third-party email app? I mean, we have Outlook now, but that's owned by Microsoft. So that doesn't really count. Outlook doesn't have to make money in and of itself, right? But I would imagine that AirMail does. And if you look at even something like Mailbox, you know, not, I feel like if Mailbox had been a paid app that was wildly successful, maybe Dropbox would have kept it. I don't know. But you see what I'm saying? Like, I understand that the future's exciting, but like, I can't help but think about all the clients that we've loved that have come and gone as well.
I think the future, if you're an indie developer doing email clients, the future is in power users. Power users are a very peculiar breed of human. They like apps with, you know, that make them save time and make them more efficient, and they're not, pain is not a problem. And I think it's smart to make, to kind of market an email client as the email app for power users with a lot of settings, with a paid upfront kind of model. And we've seen this happen with OmniFocus To Do. People are not afraid to pay for software that they use. And with the problem with email is that, unlike a task manager, email works at scale. So you gotta integrate with the services, you know, Gmail, iCloud, and you gotta have this sort of scaling server components such as search or push notifications. And it can be tricky to balance, you know, I want to make a free email client and make money off, you know, data in some way, or advertising, or I want to make the, or integrations, you know, I want to make partnerships and make money that way. Or maybe I don't want to make money at all if I'm Google and Microsoft, because my company is big enough to make money in other ways. I just want to provide an email service. Or maybe, you know, you want to sell an email client and have all of these features. I think AirMail has a better shot at surviving than other apps that are free and that have no clear way of making money down the road, unless an acquisition is in sight, or maybe you wanna, you know, you wanna discontinue the client and you know, do something else with it. I think Caramel as an indie product has a better chance of surviving. I mean, we've seen that with Caramel on the Mac. It's been going on for 3 years. The developers charge for the app on OS X, and you know, with free services and free apps, there's always the risk of them being discontinued. That's also the case with paid apps. But I statistically have better faith in a small team selling an email client at a price than, you know, this sort of venture-backed or, you know, email client that's free and you don't really know how it makes money. But hey, look at that. It's a shiny new toy and eventually will disappear. We'll see.
All right, we got a little bit more to talk about this week, but first we're going to take a break and thank our friends over at Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code WORLD at checkout to get 10% off. When it comes to giving yourself a place online, there's nowhere better than Squarespace. They put all the power you need into your hands and take away the pain points like worrying about hosting, scaling, or what to do if you get stuck with something. With Squarespace, you can build a site that looks professionally designed regardless of skill level. There's no coding required. They have intuitive and easy-to-use tools that allow you to make your website look and feel exactly how you want. Squarespace has all the state-of-the-art technology you would expect. They power your site and ensure security and stability. And they're trusted by millions of people and some of the most respected brands around the world. Here at Relay, we use Squarespace for our online merchandise store. You can go buy T-shirts and stickers and everything, and they handle it all for us. Safe and secure, super fast, super easy. And their site templates are stunning to look at. They all feature responsive design, so they look great on any size device, from an iPhone to an iPad up through a Mac. You know that your site will look good. But this is all just getting started. Squarespace has tons of awesome features, like 24/7 support with live chat and email. They have teams located in New York, Dublin, and Portland who are all there ready to help. And Squarespace commerce platform, like I just mentioned, allows anyone to add a store to their Squarespace site. You don't have to be an e-commerce genius to figure this out. The commerce platform, very simple, very easy to use. And if you're looking to build a great-looking single-page website, then the cover page program is for you. And all this is backed by rock-solid, fast hosting, and so much more. If you want to stretch Squarespace even further, you should check out their developer platform. You can dig into the code and tinker with your Squarespace site directly. If you sign up for a year, you also get a free domain name, allowing you to choose exactly what you want your site to be called. Squarespace plans start at just $8 a month. The trial is no credit card required, so you can start building your website today by going to squarespace.com. And if you decide to sign up, make sure to use the offer code WORLD for 10% off your first purchase. And that helps show your support for Connected. We'd like to thank Squarespace for the support of this show and all of Relay FM. Squarespace, you should. Federico, what did you buy?
I bought a Synology device, network attached storage, little media server that I keep at home and I'm having lots of fun with. I assume you want to know the backstory here.
I do. I also want to know, because I'm a nerd, which model you bought.
I bought, and I know some people were upset by my decision, I bought the DS 214 Play. And I bought that one instead of the DS216 because it was cheaper. I looked up the reviews on AnandTech and there was no significant change for stuff that I was mostly interested in. And it was cheaper on Amazon and it had Prime shipping. And so, you know.
And this is a two-bay.
This is a two-bay NAS. I bought initially a 4 terabyte Western Digital Red drive. Only
good,
bought one.
Good choice.
Only bought, yeah, thank you. I did my research. I only bought one. Then I realized I was being stupid. I needed to have a RAID configuration. And so I bought the second one and enabled what they call the SHR, which is the RAID automatic type of, you know, setting from Synology itself. And I set it up, and now my first drive is mirrored to the second one. And so if a drive fails, I should have the second one ready to go. So the reason I bought this, I explained this in the email to Club Mac Stories members on Sunday. My girlfriend and I have been growing increasingly insecure about backups. My girlfriend, she has an old MacBook. We put an SSD in it a couple of years ago, actually, maybe even more, 3 to 4 years ago. And the MacBook is still doing okay, but eventually it's going to die. And she wants to have a Time Machine backup. We didn't have a Time Machine volume. We are firmly against cables, so we wanted to have a wireless Time Machine volume. We don't have an Apple AirPort Extreme or Time Capsule because we prefer Netgear, hardware in our house for wireless needs. So we wanted to have a wireless volume for Time Machine. That was the first issue. My second backup anxiety is that, you know, with all this work that I do for Mac Stories, Club Mac Stories, and Relay, I deal with a lot of documents and data that, okay, I do backup with iCloud, but I always, and I do keep in Dropbox or Box, but I felt like having a redundant option, you know, that I control would make me feel safer. And then there's the media problem, which is we watch a lot of TV shows, a lot of movies every night. Sorry. And we want to have the kind of workflow that doesn't force us to use a Mac to download them. Because every weekend or, you know, every 2 weeks lately, we go back to Viterbo, our hometown. We don't want to put a Mac in our suitcase. We just want to bring my iPad Pro. We don't want to bring the Mac just to watch TV shows and to download them because, you know, downloads on iOS are terrible. So my idea was we can either buy a Mac Mini or we can buy a NAS right now. Eventually, I believe the Mac Mini is the better option for me, but, you know, this year we'll see how the new MacBooks are. But right now, we wanted to have something that we could, you know, set up and forget about it for the rest of the year or really for the future. So we went with this analogy because I've been reading for the past few years, you know, my friend Gabe at Mac Drifter, he owns a Synology. My friend Don also, you know, used to write for Mac Stories. He has a Synology. And, you know, everyone I know that has a Synology were super satisfied with the product. So I thought, you know, I want to have backups. I want to organize all my TV shows and movies and some music that I no longer listen to because it's not available on streaming services. I want to organize them. I want to have them in a single location. And at this point, I also have a fiber connection, which is fast, and it allows me to upload and download at crazy speeds, at least for me, for my standards. I should really buy a Synology. And it really was a few coincidences and maybe late realizations that led us to buy one and set it up. And it's now in our kitchen in a fancy piece of furniture. At least we think it's fancy from IKEA. So, you know, the fancy scale is objectable. But it's working quite well for us. So I'm mostly using the default Synology apps. So the DS apps that they have, like DS Video and DS Audio. Mm-hmm. I know that I could use Plex, but for some reason, the port that Plex uses, it's not working for my connection, whereas the DS Video one is working just fine, both on Wi-Fi and 4G. Synology gives you this quick connect sort of online component that allows you to access your NAS from outside of the local network. And that's been working super well for me so far. And I set up a DS Video with folders where I can watch TV shows and movies. I downloaded some albums like rare EPs and live performances from Oasis and Death Cab for Cutie that are not available on Apple Music and Spotify. And I don't want to use YouTube because, you know, I'm not an animal. So I keep them in the Synology and I listen with the DS Audio app, which is a fine app. It lets you stream music. It lets you download songs locally. It works for me. and we're watching TV shows, we're watching movies, listen to music, and the last aspect, at least for now, I configured the Cloud Sync feature that basically lets you mirror online services like Box or Google Drive or Dropbox back into the Synology. So you have a backup of those online services running on your local device. And so that gives me, you know, the peace of mind of knowing that, yes, I do save all of my critical work files in Box and Dropbox, but if something ever goes wrong with those accounts, I also have a copy on my Synology. So that's what we're doing so far.
Yeah, I mean, I what I really like about these things is that you can expand what you do with it as time goes on. So yeah. If you do decide to do Plex or do decide something else, then it's a very modular system because unlike a hard drive sitting on, you know, just sitting directly, you know, over USB or Thunderbolt or something, this is a computer. So you can, like the Cloud Sync, for instance, you know, it's running that whether or not your Mac or iPad is in the house. If you're, you know, someplace else and are doing something in Dropbox or Box, then the Synology is keeping up with it on its own because it is a self-contained unit. And that gives you a lot of flexibility and power in setting things up to just to run and just to take care of things when you're not actively interacting with the Box, which I think is really great. And I had a four-bay one for over a year and had a hardware issue with it and then ended up not keeping it. But I've got a Mac Mini at home on the network, and it takes over, has taken over a lot of those things that the NAS did. But really the idea is the same, is having something always on the network that can take care of things, that can host backups, can, you know, host files, share media. It really is a very useful thing if you need that sort of functionality.
Yeah, and I appreciate how the company has a suite of mobile apps. They are updated for the latest iOS versions. There's like some crazy stuff that I'm not going to use. There's a note-taking app called DS Note. It's like a mix of Evernote and a task manager. There's a traditional file manager that lets you browse folders and, you know, create shortcuts and that kind of stuff. And then there's a DS Video and Audio, which is the media experience. And the ones with the, you know, the crazy people can even install a beta of the Synology OS version 6. But I thought about it for like a couple of seconds. Then I read, you cannot downgrade to the stable version. And I'm like, nope, not going to do that on my new fancy toy that I'm using for backups and TV shows. So yeah, the company is really, you know, they have updates coming. They have mobile apps. The hardware is solid and it's extendable. So, you know, I'm having lots of fun.
Awesome. I think we'll wrap up this week talking about this rumor of the March 15th Apple event, which is Gurman posted this a couple hours ago as we record, and basically kind of bringing together all the stuff we've been talking about. So the 5 SE, iPad Air 3, which I think is the most interesting thing that we haven't really talked about, and then sort of a watch refresh, not new watch hardware itself, but new bands. Potentially a software update, you know, the sort of the accessory side of the watch. I think what's most interesting to me, though, for today is the iPad Air 3, and the reports over the last couple of weeks have really congealed around it being an iPad Pro Mini. So having four speakers, having a smart connector, which means that, you know, the potentially a new smart keyboard or third-party keyboards could interface like they do on the iPad Pro, and then even potentially pencil support. What, I mean, the iPad Air 2 is a great device and is powerful and has really held up. But Federico, do you think that they need to make the Air like a little Pro, or do you think that there's room to keep some of those Pro features only on the 12-inch model?
Well, it makes sense for some features to trickle down from the Pro to the Air line. I don't know if there's a need for all of them. So, you know, the crazy CPU or the 4 gigs of RAM or the pencil, but definitely the speaker system and the smart connector make sense to me. The pencil is the big question, right? Because Apple pushed the iPad Pro with the pencil as a unique proposition from the company, you know, for artists and, you know, users who needed a better input device. The Pro and the pencil seem to go together as a single product. So breaking out the pencil from the Pro line and, you know, extending compatibility with the iPad Air would be interesting to, you know, to see what happens there. But I do believe that the speaker system and the accessory support with the smart connector makes sense to me. I think Apple needs to always offer new reasons to upgrade an iPad to the latest model. If anything, because a lot of people are don't buy iPads like they buy iPhones. There's still people who have an iPad 2 or, you know, an iPad 4. Remember that guy?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people still have those. And they see an iPad Air and it doesn't have, you know, it's faster and it's lighter, but it doesn't have new things, right? I mean, two speakers and a new connector, that's new stuff for people. The pencil will be even better. So I guess it makes sense to kind of try crazy things first with the Pro and eventually, you know, having the technology come down to the iPad Air and maybe with, you know, slightly inferior CPU or RAM, I don't know. And of course, you know, the big difference would be the user experience, just using iOS. It can be the same version of iOS and it can be the same set of accessories and hardware, but just using iOS on the iPad Air and on the iPad Pro is, for me, better on the Pro because it's bigger. You could have the same features and, you know, exactly the same set of accessories on both devices, and yet I would still prefer the Pro because, you know, iOS is bigger and it's more comfortable. And it wouldn't be the first time that, you know, we would end with a sort of scenario where every iPad is essentially the same and you just got to pick a size. Apple did this before with the iPad Mini and the iPad Air, and now I wouldn't be surprised to see the iPad Air and the iPad Pro sharing the same stage in terms of features. And it's just a matter of screen size. So the rumor makes sense to me. The big question mark is the pencil, at least for me. So I guess we'll see in about a month if the rumor's true. And it has to be because it's Gurman. So
I agree with you on all of that. I think that Apple has to do what it can to make each release exciting. And I think that holding things just for the iPad Pro because it's big or because it's special in some way is not the strategy they need to be pursuing right now. If the iPad was not in more or less free fall, I think it would be different. But I think they have to try to put the brakes on that in any way possible. And I think the flip side of that, especially with the pencil, is that if they get this into the Air 3, and I still think the 9.7-inch iPad is sort of the default one for most people,
yeah.
Especially as phones have gotten bigger. I think the Mini is sort of more specialized than maybe it once was at the beginning. I think that that will be encouraging to developers to support the pencil in their apps, or for developers who make very pencil-focused apps, like it's a lot of these drawing and art apps, I think there's benefit to them as well. That, hey, you know, I'm not building this app that for only people who bought the Pro, but Air 3 users can use it as well, and over time it trickles down and down. And so I think the pencil makes a lot of sense for the 9.7-inch screen. I also agree with you that I'm not particularly tempted by it. Except for, you know, reading in bed or something, the iPad Pro has really clicked with me because iOS is, it benefits from the breathing room, and especially the multitasking stuff in iOS 9. Even using it on an Air 2 feels cramped after being on the Pro. So I don't see myself particularly tempted by this model, but I do think that there will be people who are, and who look at some of the stuff that the Pro can do, and especially with the pencil, and don't want to sacrifice, you know, the size or the weight, or don't want to spend $1,000. And, you know, the Air being a good bit cheaper, I think will help bring this technology to more people. So I think it makes a ton of sense from a strategy standpoint. And I will say that I'd be surprised and disappointed if the Pencil doesn't show up on the iPad Air this time around.
Yeah, you can buy the same furniture, you can buy the same couch and the same TV sets, and then you gotta choose, do you want to live in a small house or do you want to live in a big house? It's just a matter of preference. It's, you want to be cozy, you know, with all the stuff closer together, or do you want to be comfortable and, you know, have a big real estate? That's just a matter of your preference. I believe that's the best way to go in the future. And also because people don't want the big tablet or, you know, just want to see the Air as the default, also because it's cheaper. Having pro hardware aspects come down to the most commercially viable iPad is also an incentive for developers to make more pro apps, if you think about it. Having the standard tablet becoming more pro is a benefit for everyone, not just for the pros. You know, it's almost like slowly but surely pro features of MacBook Pros became available to MacBooks, and everyone saw the benefit in that. So I see the same happening with the iPad. I don't know. It just may be strange to think about because it's so close to the to the iPad Pro release when Apple made a big deal of, you know, the Pencil is exclusive to the iPad Pro. It's our best iPad ever. And now, like 5 months later, there's the possibility of the iPad Air gaining the same features. That's maybe what's strange right now. But if you think about it, like from a higher perspective, it makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, I don't think Apple's ever won to really hold themselves to past statements. So if they say, oh, it's exclusive to the iPad Pro, well, that's not untrue.
Man, it was at the time.
You can't do it. Yeah. And if they are doing this, this may explain why the iPad Air 3, maybe they wanted it to be exclusive to the Pro for some reason, and maybe that's why this is in the spring. But I also think that, I think overall, Apple is slowing down the iPad release cycle. And I think that makes sense. I think that burning resources to make a new iPad every 12 months when people clearly aren't updating that often is, I think that's fine. And so to make the each individual, you know, product or SKU, you know, good enough to last a couple of years. And the iPad Air 2 has held up really well. And, you know, we all said when they came out, this is overkill. And now with iOS 9 multitasking, we see that, you know, it handles that well. And it was obviously built with that sort of thing in mind eventually. But the Pro is a different beast and is a lot more powerful. So, and I don't know if the Air 3 would have the 4 gigs of RAM or the exact same processor configuration, but I would expect it to be plenty powerful for the next, you know, 18 to 24 months if they continue to slow down this cycle. So, but thankfully, we only have a couple of weeks, or I guess about a month, to wait and see what happens.
Yeah, yeah, it's gonna be interesting, you know. I want to try an Air 3. I'm pretty sure I'm not gonna switch because I just love iOS on the big screen. But it's an interesting product for me to consider. So we'll see.
Yep. Well, I think that does it for this week. You can find our show notes, like I said, in your podcast app of choice or on our website, relay.fm/connected/76. You can find Federico at macstories.net or on Twitter at VITICCI. You can find Mike, who is homesick today, but you can find him on Twitter as well at iMike. I am at ISMH on Twitter, and 512pixels.net is where I spend my time writing about computers that are older than some of my readers now.
That's true.
It's true. It's, yeah, that's, there's that. So feel free to get in touch. You can send us feedback from the website, get in touch on Twitter, let us know what we messed up, and we will address it in follow up. I think that's it. So till next time, Federico, say goodbye.
Arrivederci.
Adios.